And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
The latest report by the renowned Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is in. So what's it say? The conclusions will affect every person, bird, tortoise, flower, and sea squirt on Earth for many years to come. You'll hear the summary, and then we're heading off to San Francisco to check on the status of the cleanup of the devastating oil spill that occurred less than 2 weeks ago in San Francisco Bay. That and the Nature News is coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
This last weekend, delegates assembled in Valencia, Spain, to receive the final assessment report on climate change. The results of years of study and synthesis by over 400 scientists from around the world. This is, to date, the most comprehensive and authoritative study on climate change, and will form the basis for the drafting of national and international policy at the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, convening in Bali, December 3rd through the 14th. This is a very significant next step in crafting an international response to climate change, the only way, many feel, the challenges of global warming can be effectively addressed. You will hear segments of the press conference announcing the findings during the weekly Earth Summit, coming up in just a moment. In segment two, following this week's Nature News, we'll be talking with Cheryl Surface, who directed the planning for the emergency cleanup of the recent oil spill in San Francisco Bay, the worst ecological disaster in that area in decades. Coordinating the containment and massive cleanup effort takes a surprising amount of machinery, advanced technologies, manpower, and experience. An army of hazmat-clad responders, backed up by an armada of ships, planes, helicopters, and trucks, fanned out throughout the waters and shorelines to snatch up every bit of the toxic ooze. As well, local citizens launched their own response, taking to the tarry beaches to pull the thousands of devastated birds from their quagmire. Cheryl provides the perspective from one who takes on the responsibility to assure that safety for humans and impacted creatures and environments is directed by those experienced in similar oil cleanup efforts. That's all coming up, but now, as always, it's time for the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith. This past weekend, the efforts of hundreds of the world's leading scientists culminated in the release of the synthesis report of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Today, we bring you excerpts from the news conference held to announce its findings. What you are about to hear will form the basis of how we, as the people and societies of this Earth, respond to the rapid changes we will experience as the effects of global warming continue to be felt from the deepest reaches of our oceans to the highest peaks and mountains, and to everything in between, which forms the thin living veil. This will bring you up to the minute on the status of global warming on planet Earth. So now, we listen in as the conference gets underway.
Mr. Secretary General, on behalf of the core writing team for this synthesis report, all the authors who contributed to the working group reports on which this synthesis report is based, as well as all the members of the IPCC, it's a great privilege for me to to give you a copy, the first copy of the summary for policymakers of this document, sir.
Thank you very much. It's a great time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you could take your seats, please. Good morning and welcome to this press conference. Sitting at the center is, of course, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, and Dr. Rajendra Pachauri, the Chairman of the IPCC. Next to Dr. Pachauri is Michel Jarraud, the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, and next to the Secretary General is Mr. Achim Steiner, the Executive Director of the UN Environmental Program. The Secretary General will have a few opening remarks, and then Dr. Pachauri will present the IPCC synthesis report, and then we will open the floor to your questions, and we will also take a few questions that are being emailed by other journalists. Secretary General, you have the floor.
With the IPCC's latest work, the stage is now set for the United Nations Climate Change Conference, which gets underway in 2 weeks in Bali, Indonesia. This conference is so very critical. It is in Bali that governments will have to provide political solutions to what we are now well-established scientific facts. The breakthrough needed in Bali is an agreement to launch negotiations for a comprehensive climate change deal that all nations can embrace, developed and developing alike. Scientists have now done their work, and I call on political leaders to do theirs and agree not only to launch negotiations, but also to conclude them by 2009. Having just witnessed with my own eyes a few days ago in Antarctica and in the Amazon rainforest, the effects of a changing climate, I can tell you with assurance that global, sweeping, concerted action is needed now. There is no time to waste. Thank you very much. And now I will turn the proceedings over to Dr. Pachauri. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Secretary General. It's a privilege for me to be sitting by your side and presenting some of the major findings of the synthesis report, which is part of the fourth assessment report of the IPCC. I'm going to present some of the findings, but at the end I'm also going to raise some crucial questions which incidentally I as an individual have formulated and which I hope the delegates that would take part in the conference of the parties in Bali will consider and ponder over at some length. The fourth assessment report, of which the synthesis report is the final part, is an enormous effort, as the Secretary General has just informed you. It took about 450 lead authors from over 130 countries, and including, of course, the 2,500 scientific expert reviewers and 800 contributing authors. I'd also like to highlight our findings related to extreme events, and I would now mention just a few as an example. The frequency of heavy precipitation events has increased over most areas. Then from 1900 to 2005, precipitation increased significantly in eastern parts of North and South America, Northern Europe, and Northern and Central Asia. But it declined in the Sahel, the Mediterranean, Southern Africa, and parts of Southern Asia. And globally, the area affected by drought has likely increased since the 1970s. There's now higher confidence that in the third assessment report, in projected patterns of warming and other regional scale features, including changes in wind patterns, precipitation, and some aspects of extremes and sea ice. The rate of global average sea level rise has risen from 1.8 millimeters per year to 3.1 millimeters per year from 1961 to 1993. The reasons for sea level rise has been due to thermal expansion, melting glaciers and ice caps, and the polar ice sheets. Projected sea level rise at the end of the 21st century will be in the range 18 to 59 centimeters. It's projected to be in the range of 18 to 59 centimeters. Human-induced warming would lead to some impacts that are abrupt or irreversible, and these include partial loss of ice sheets on ice polar land, which could imply meters of sea level rise, major changes in coastlines and inundation of low-lying areas, great effects in river deltas and low-lying islands, and approximately 20 to 30% of species assessed so far are likely to be at increased risk of extinction. The large-scale and persistent changes in the meridional overturning circulation, referred to as the MOC, will have impacts on marine ecosystem productivity, fisheries, ocean CO2 uptake, and terrestrial vegetation. Fortunately, humanity has within its reach a number of solutions, some of which are related to our perception of problems and attendant solutions, and our ability to put in place policy measures that would facilitate the implementation of those solutions. A wide variety of policies and instruments are available to governments to create the incentives for mitigation action. Stabilization levels assessed can be achieved by deployment of a portfolio of technologies that are either currently available or expected to be commercialized in the coming decades. And an effective carbon price signal could realize significant mitigation potential in all sectors. So this is an important finding. If we want action, then clearly there has to be a price attached to carbon which will move us towards a low carbon economy. I'd also like to raise some equity issues. The impacts of climate change are not going to be felt uniformly. For instance, in Africa, between 75 to 250 million people are projected to be exposed to increased water stress. This will be by 2020. And in some countries, yields from rain-fed agriculture would be reduced by 50%. And in Asia, you have problems of freshwater availability, coastal areas being affected, particularly the mega-delta regions, which are really at the highest risk from sea flooding. And the small island states are particularly vulnerable because they would not only suffer from inundation, storm surge, erosion, and other such hazards, but also by mid-century, reduced water resources in many small island states will make it impossible for them to meet their own needs for water.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pachauri. I will ask you to raise your hand if you want to ask a question.
There seems to be a disconnect with the urgency with which you, sirs, are now talking and the glacial slowness of the political process towards any kind of agreement that begins to meet the scale of the cuts in carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases that are needed. Does that, my perception there, coincide with yours? And if so, what should be done about it?
I think by this time, the scientists have determined in one voice unequivocally the very quickening pace of global warming phenomenon. And as you said, I have witnessed myself with my own eyes while visiting Antarctica. While I was able to appreciate such a wonderful and very rare landscape, but I was very alarmed. It was very disturbing for me personally to see all this quickening and process of melting ice.
Thank you. Before we go to the floor, I'll read out a question that's been emailed to us from the Sunday Independent in South Africa and maybe from Mr. Steiner. Senior UN environmental officials have said on numerous occasions that climate change can be beaten, and that there are real affordable ways to deal with climate change. Could you please give us examples of real and affordable ways individuals, companies, and governments can deal with climate change?
Thank you. I think the report, and if you look at the synthesis reports, identifies the major contributing sectors in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And what is striking as a first example is that it is our infrastructure, our buildings, these very edifices that we have built over the last 100, 200 years and continue to build even in the year 2007 as if there was no global warming. we can achieve significant greenhouse gas reductions simply by dealing with energy efficiency use, by introducing innovative technology. And just a couple of days ago at the governing board of the International Labour Organization, the discussion was about how climate change would in fact create jobs in the future. I think Dr. Pachauri can provide many figures in terms of how the IPCC has tried to capture the economics, the economic rationale of in fact addressing global warming, providing innovation in our industries, creating new jobs and also creating new markets. In addition to that, we have the challenge of adaptation, and here it is more about how do we avoid losing what we have gained over hundreds of years of development, and here the equation is a much more difficult one. But even here, the report shows that there are gains to be made, and if you look at the whole question of reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation, we can have win-win-win propositions for the world, but for that we have to agree, and we have to agree quickly.
Hi, Richard Black from the BBC. Perhaps I could ask Achim Steiner just to enlarge on the comments that he made there. It's quite clear from the summary for policymakers that if nothing changes in terms of the global regime, we're going to see emissions rise further and faster, greater use of coal, etc., etc. Yet you outlined your view that it is possible to turn that around. So could you give us a sort of roadmap for decarbonizing the global economy relevant to industrialized countries, middle-ranking countries, and the less developed countries, how you think things ought to proceed in the next decade or so?
In very simple terms, if we want to meet the targets that the IPCC has given us, it has also given us the numbers that need to be achieved in terms of removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. I mentioned the building sector, the transport sector, the energy generation sector, and also the agriculture and forestry sectors. In all of these sectors, the IPCC, and indeed Sir Nicholas Stern also with his report, and many other scientific reports that have contributed to our knowledge, including from the private sector, have shown areas in where we can make gains. The simple light bulb example has become, if you want, a symbol for that measure, but with one light bulb you can reduce your electricity consumption by 4/5. It is the simplest act almost for a consumer today, and there are countries who have replaced their entire stock of light bulbs already on this planet. There are corporations that are able to use their energy more efficiently. We can look at also the issue of transport. Why is it that in the year 2007, when we have technology to motor and power vehicles with 4 litres per 100 kilometres, we are still building and selling cars with 16, 18 litres per 100 kilometres? We have hybrid technology, we have others that have been in the pipeline for a long time. It is also time that industry and the private sector offer the market the products that will allow us to achieve those greenhouse gas emission reductions. And here the report makes a very important distinction between the economic mitigation potential and the market mitigation potential. The private sector, the consumer and the markets need signals that governments can give through legislation, incentives and subsidies that make sense from a carbon management perspective, but may not make sense from me as an individual or me as a corporation. That is why the IPCC, that is why the negotiations in Bali are so critical, because unless governments provide the markets of this world the right signals and the right incentives, these transitions that are listed in these reports will simply not happen, because the market alone cannot deliver. But the market with the right incentives and the right regulatory frameworks is perfectly capable of delivering gigatons of reductions in greenhouse gas emissions in the timelines that the IPCC has shown so very clearly in its report.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of my fellow conference officer, Susan Hansen, and myself, I'd like to wish you farewell and have a good journey home. Thank you.
It's off to Bali now, as the focus shifts from summary to national and international policies. As representatives from 180 nations, world leaders, NGOs, and media debate and formulate the follow-up to the Kyoto Protocols between December 3rd through the 14th. This world-changing event will define the strategies that are to counter this global threat. We'll be reporting from Bali as it happens. Until then, we'll return next week with the weekly Earth Summit. It's bad enough that global warming is creating such a variety of challenges that range from flooding from too much rain to droughts from too little. As well, we have to live with the direct consequences when we humans make little mistakes that result in some giant messes. In just a moment, we talk with the woman who directed the planning for the cleanup of the massive toxic fuel spill by the COSCO Busan less than 2 weeks ago in San Francisco Bay. That's coming up when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
What happens when a huge Chinese container ship, trying to make its way through the fog-shrouded night of San Francisco's bay, scrapes against the piling of the Bay Bridge, ripping a long gash that cuts into the fuel tanks and releases 58,000 gallons of toxic fuel into this historic landmark and ecosystem? You'll find out about this and more when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. It seems we hear of a new natural or environmental disaster every few days. Less than 2 weeks ago, the Chinese COSCO Busan, an enormous container ship, hit one of the massive pilings of the Bay Bridge, and the bridge won, cutting a long, deep gash in the massive cargo ship, which quickly turned into the area's worst environmental disaster in decades. Within moments, the response script began unfolding, as the Coast Guard was alerted to a spillage estimated at 140 gallons of fuel. An immediate series of predetermined actions were initiated. Following today's Nature News, we'll be talking with Cheryl Surface, who was one of those called as a first responder to be part of the lead team charged with addressing this monumental disaster. We on the outside must rely on getting our information from the media. We see the images, hear the news clips, and moan and squirm as the size and scope of the disaster unfolds. Cheryl Surface, however, must act, and act quickly, to contain the spill, protect sensitive sites, and administer the myriad response teams who are suddenly thrust literally onto and into the waters to mop up the toxic goo. It's a daunting task, the scope of which may not be effectively portrayed during our news bites, as you'll hear following this week's Nature News update. So now, the news. As gas prices surge ahead to keep pace with the record-breaking oil prices, which are expected to hit $100 any day now, others are already beginning to lay the groundwork for prices of $125 and $150 a barrel. Robert Mabro, director of the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, who advises OPEC on pricing trends and strategies, said he did not know if the $100 benchmark is sustainable, and predicted that with such crazy prices causing uncertainty in the oil futures market, oil prices could easily rise $20 or $30 per barrel. Mr. Mabro said that it's reasonable to expect that prices could range up to $150 before too long. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has challenged the world's policymakers to start devising a comprehensive plan for tackling climate change at next month's summit in Bali, Indonesia, after a United Nations report released November 17th found that global warming is unequivocal and could cause irreversible damage to the planet. Launching the fourth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, which brings together hundreds of scientific experts, Mr. Ban said that slowing and even reversing the effects of climate change is the defining challenge of our age. He also stressed the report makes clear that concerted and sustained action now can still avoid some of the most catastrophic scenarios in the IPCC forecasts. A new study suggests that a holistic approach is needed in assessing the potential environmental and health effects of toxic effluents from industry. The researchers point out that the prediction of wastewater toxicity usually does not take into account any possible interactions between the compounds in the wastewater sample. The presence of a particular chemical may make another more easily absorbed by aquatic creatures or plants, for instance. Moreover, some highly toxic chemicals may be undetected in a complex wastewater mixture. 4 days after Super Cyclone Siddur killed more than 2,400 people in Bangladesh, rescuers were struggling to reach isolated areas along the country's devastated coast and give aid to millions of survivors. Media reports and the chairman of the Bangladesh Red Crescent Society, Mohammed Abdur Rab, so the death toll had already surpassed 3,000 and was likely to go up. The government put the official toll at 2,471 confirmed dead. While it will take several days to determine the number of dead and missing, some 3 million survivors who were either evacuated from the low-lying southern coast or whose homes and villages were destroyed will need support, the government said. And that's the news. And a few announcements. The Wildside News has a new broadcast schedule moving its airing day from each Thursday to each Tuesday. Join in then, or any time, so that you can know you are tuned in. And now to today's feature. On Wednesday, November 7th, there was an accident in the San Francisco Bay that resulted in a major oil spill, particularly in an area like that, right in the middle of a metropolitan area, as well surrounded by very sensitive natural areas. And there was an immediate response to try to deal with this extraordinary crisis. And here we are, a week and a half later. And to some extent, that incident is under control, and the process now is where do we go from here and the cleanup from this point forward. I'm very pleased to have on the Wildside News now someone who is absolutely involved from day one in trying to organize and plan the recovery effort following the oil spill by the Costco Busan. Cheryl Surface, who is talking to us now from Reno. Cheryl, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
Cheryl, you work with a group called the O'Brien's Group, which was called immediately upon the notification that there was this spill. Why don't you talk about why that is, the O'Brien's Group, what they do, then we'll talk about what your process was that led to this time and where we go from here.
Thank you, Sydney. The O'Brien's Group is a responsible contractor, and based on the regulations of the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, vessels who transport hazardous materials must identify a local-based response contractor who, should they have an accident or an event, is located in the United States and can be responsible for oversight and deployment in response to the accident. And the O'Brien's Group is one of those. They have clients throughout the United States that they respond to their events, should they have them.
Now, you're actually a subcontractor with the O'Brien's Group. They call on you because you have quite a bit of experience in crisis management.
Well, my background is basically in the fire service, and I spent 25 years in the fire service, and primarily that was in Alaska. So in 1989, when the vessel Exxon Valdez had an accident resulting in the regulations that are in place now, there was a group of us from the fire service that moved into doing training for oil companies as a result of those compliance issues. And so we started doing incident management training using the incident command system for oil clients, primarily in Alaska, and then moved out to other clients throughout the world.
The incident happened on November 7th. When did you get your call from the O'Brien's group?
As per the regulation, vessel actually called the U.S. Coast Guard since it happened on U.S. Coast Guard waters. The U.S. Coast Guard then is regulated to cascade through the state notifications as well as the responsible party notifications. So as soon as the O'Brien's group received that notification, they then cascaded through their network to not only respond to the incident, so they have contractors in place that responded with skimmers, booms, actual contractors that were going to the incident itself. And subsequently, they put in the call to their network folks to find out their availability for response as far as management for the incident went.
You know, an incident like that is an enormous event. If anybody has looked at, for example, the maps of the spread, it really covered most of the bay and headed out into the open waters as well. And we'll talk about that. But it's hard to imagine how in the world a person responds. And you were very much involved in planning from day one. Tell us what some of your first concerns were when you get on the ground.
This particular incident, when the O'Brien's group received the first call, they immediately activated two response contractors who have vessels and boom capabilities to respond directly to the vessel itself to try and contain the product coming out of the vessel and start actually skimming the product immediately. And then the subcontractors, such as myself, we came in to manage the incident. So literally when I got the call, got on an airplane and flew over to Oakland and responded to the initial command post, which was set up at the Coast Guard facility in Yerba Buena. And I was given a listing of vessels and personnel and equipment that had been responding to the incident, as well as a listing of equipment, personnel, and supplies that were en route to the incident. And that evening, I was tasked with developing the plan for the next operational period or the next day, utilizing the resources that were not only on scene, but those that were coming to the incident over the next 24-hour operational period. So that night, we sat in the office and developed a plan and a strategy to implement that plan for November 8th. And we just continued that process throughout the incident.
The COSCO, the Busan, is actually a container vessel, so it's not a tanker ship. But unfortunately, it hit pier and tore a gaping hole in the side of the vessel. And, you know, the stories that I'm hearing through the media, which is my only real source, is that for quite some time, but whoever was steering that craft at that time, it was very dense fog. Didn't quite realize the degree to which the ship had been damaged. And strangely enough, it happened to hit their fuel tanks, which then bled into the bay. Now, this is different than crude oil. This is actually a fuel oil.
Yeah, it is. It's a bunker, and it's actually used as like a gasoline for a car, only it's not a gasoline product. It's a very similar product to a crude oil in visual reference. And it's dark in color, its consistency is thick, and it's not like a diesel or gasoline product, which is very light and flashy fuel. This is a persistent product, and so its characteristics look very much like a crude oil when it's on the water.
Mm-hmm.
This particular incident didn't happen in very dense fog. So the first report resulted around the fact that there was very dense fog. It did strike the structure. There was floating timbers in the water. The initial response vessels were responding to a report of a collision with the pier. And when they were on scene, there was floating timbers from the pier along with product. So it's very hard to determine what actually has occurred in the situation such as this where there's dense fog. So immediately they responded to the worst case. So the response vessels that went with their booming strategies and their skimming capabilities responded based on the call. But, of course, we sent everything we had available in the bay at that particular time.
Mm-hmm. Which was a wise decision.
Exactly.
As things developed, originally reports were that it was 150 gallons or so, but it turned out to be much more significant and ultimately 58,000 gallons. That's
well, you've got to understand that the very dense fog, captains on the bridge can't really see over the side of the boat, probably did not have a clear picture of what the extent of the damage to the vessel were, you know, until they were able to move the vessel and actually gauge the tanks and find out how much product released into the environment versus how much product was left in those tanks. They immediately started transferring fuel from the damaged tanks to empty tanks on the vessel.
So So you arrive, and you're finding out, probably by the time that you got there, you knew that this was a much larger incident. What was your first concern? What do you do at that point to immediately go into action to contain this situation?
Well, from my perspective, I'm the planning section chief, and so I work very hand-in-hand with the Unified Command and the operations folks in order to make sure that we implement the best operational strategies we can for the next operational period. So when I come, like I said, I got a listing of response vessels and equipment personnel that had previously gone out in the initial call out, that had been cascading in throughout the course of the day, and that we expected to be available for operations at first light the next day. So when I came in to the project that evening on November 7th, my job was basically to put together and document a plan of action for that next operational period to make sure that we had the equipment, personnel, and supplies available to continue the response efforts and build up the response effort forward from the initial accident.
In terms of planning priorities, what are your concerns?
Well, our first priority, of course, is safety. And our second priority is environmental constraints. And then our third, you know, is economics. But we look at a safety standpoint. So when we're responding to this incident, safety is our number one priority. But then number two, we're looking at the environmental concerns and considerations. So while we're responding with skimming capabilities, we're also responding with booming strategies. So along up and down the entire coastlines and throughout the United States, there are area contingency plans in place. And these area contingency plans have been developed with state and federal regulations, and they identify sensitive areas throughout the bay. So as we're responding with skimming capabilities, we're also responding with strategies to protect those environmentally sensitive areas. So we're deploying boom at the same time we're skimming product off the water. We're deploying boom to protect those sensitive areas. So that had been ongoing from the very beginning of the incident on November 7th, and those continued through November 8th and on throughout the course of numerous days, the skimming and booming strategies were being implemented.
Describe briefly, first about skimming, and then we'll talk about boom. Let's talk about skimming. What's involved with that?
There's different types of skimmers. You know, some of the skimmers are integral to the vessel themselves. So the vessel will move throughout the water and be able to skim up an oily water mixture and put it in a storage tank within the vessel. Some of the skimmers operate with a belt system, so they put very similar to like a conveyor belt in the water, and it has a substance on the belt that actually attracts the oil, and they can move it up and put that oil into a container within the skimmer. There's like weir skimmers that are on the ground that kind of stir it up and bring up the product. So in this particular event, as in all of them, we used a combination of skimmers and a combination of skimming vessels in order to pick up and contain the product.
You mentioned that very soon on in the incident, you start creating the booms. We'll talk about those and how they work and then the priority in terms of their placement.
The response vessels that go out, not only are they capable of skimming, they're also capable of booming. And then we have vessels that just are booming vessels. The booming strategies are, like I said, they're identified in the area contingency plan as far as the environmental sensitivity goes. So we look at those ACPs and we boom according to the environmentally sensitive areas. So there's different types of boom. There's a hard boom that looks very similar. It's usually yellow in color if you visually see it. And it looks kind of like an inflatable life vest, so to speak. And that basically, you anchor it to the shoreline or you anchor it to the bottom of the bay, and you basically string it out in a long line, and that keeps the oil from encroaching on those particular sensitive locations.
It's a literal physical barrier.
It is. Mm-hmm. And then we also have a sorbent boom, and the sorbent boom is a combination. It's also a barrier, but it also acts to kind of suck up the oil. So it's white in color, looks very much like a little white sausage that goes across. Same thing, anchoring strategies to hold it in place. And then that sorbent boom then can be deployed in various locations.
Now, the first priority for the booms is to protect sensitive areas. Why don't you define some of those areas that perhaps you applied the booms to first off?
Anything that's sensitive as far as species sensitivity, as well as like marshlands, habitat for wildlife, drinking water intake areas, marine marine-like aquarium, you know, things of that nature are defined as sensitive. Most of the sensitive areas are in relationship to the environment. So, you know, species, well, whether it's, you know, birds or mammals or vegetative species that have been, you know, deemed sensitive by the environmental scientists in California.
And in this situation, about how many booms did you, how many boom locations did you identify?
There was numerous identified booms, but then, like I said, those are all in the IRA contingency plan, so we started implementing them from the very beginning. Now, a lot of those boom strategies are put in place in relationship to the projection of where the oil may go. So the oil may never have actually reached those areas that we boomed, but we put them in place just as a caution based on the trajectories that we were looking at and where we thought the oil may go.
So you're skimming and you put the booms in place and you're trying to really mop up as much of this as you can and protect the most fragile areas, but you can't protect everything. And so some of the oil, of course, ended up on the beaches themselves. The pictures of that were just horrific, this black tarry goo, and of course the impact on the wildlife. Talk about what's involved in trying to deal with that on the beaches. Let's start with that, first the beaches.
Well, you've got to remember that that oil is a dynamic product, so it moved with the tides and currents, and you have some very big fluctuations in the tides and in the bay, coming in and out of the bay, and you have a great current activity there, so it does move this product around, even though you're trying your best to skim it. During these skimming operations, we had helicopters in the air moving the skimmers into the product so that we could clean up as much as we could, but some did escape and get on to the shore side. Now, the shore side, you know, you're talking about many different types of shore sides, so you're talking about beaches, riprap rocky areas, you're talking about marshy areas, piers, docks, marinas, that kind of thing. So when we're looking at those, we have to implement different strategies based on those, whatever kind of type of shoreline environment we may be working in. So when we're looking in a big shoreline environment, we have to be very sensitive to the fact that we don't want to do more environmental damage in the cleanup process than actually cleaning up that product. So a lot of times in the shoreline cleanup process, we have scientists, trustees, for instance, National Park Service employees, biologists, those kind of people that are acting as stewards of the land. And so they go out with the cleanup crews and they identify areas that they perhaps want to avoid in the cleanup strategies, or they want to bring in specialized people so that the cleanup can be done in a way manner that's not going to harm the environment. But so we put together crews, and numerous crews for this particular incident that would be assigned different beaches, and they would be assigned to clean up and pick up the product. Now, there are regulations by OSHA requiring certain amounts of training requirements in order to deal with the hazardous material, or certain requirements in disposing of hazardous waste associated with the cleanup activity. So, and then there's a logistical support of those cleanup locations. So all of those things had to be brought into the picture. So this huge effort in putting, you know, over 1,000 people into the field on a daily basis in order to clean up the beaches and the product that was out there.
One of the stories that came out of this, and I so much respect people who care enough for the environment to, it's almost an instinct to go out and do whatever they can, and they did. And you, there were images of citizens out on the beaches working to clean up, and their intentions were absolutely on the mark. Unfortunately, as you say, in some cases, the thing that is most critical is to make sure that in the process of trying to help, you don't do more damage. I think some people may have a hard time really understanding that. Why don't you help us understand it a little farther level here, what's involved and why that is so critical. Give some examples. I think the concept of cleaning up rocks and birds, where people, although they're trying to do the right thing, could actually harm something, and it takes real expertise to know the proper procedures.
For instance, just to let you know, safety is always our number one priority. On any event we go to, safety is the number one priority. In this particular event, you're dealing with a hazardous product. So in the dealing with a hazardous product, there are OSHA regulations in place that require a certain amount of training in order to minimize the responders' harm that can actually happen to them when they're, you know, picking up a hazardous waste. So the other thing that we have to worry about is the disposal of that. So when you're picking up the oil off the beaches, and a lot of people did this, you know, just to go out and help out. Number one, they were not properly, did not have proper protective equipment on, and they would take the oily product and they would just put it in the regular waste receptacles. So you know, for instance, they would clean up the soil and they would put it in the National Park Service regular trash can. They would take it to their own home and deposit it in their own waste receptacle. So they're transferring that product throughout the whole waste stream in the Bay Area. Now, we treat it as a hazardous product. So in that regard, there are special requirements for us, too, that regulate the disposal of this hazardous waste. So it created a problem in the fact that, number one, they were exposing themselves without the proper training or the proper personal protective equipment. And number two, they were transferring this product throughout the entire waste stream, throughout the bay. So that meant that I kind of liken it to taking your oil out of your car and just dumping it down your drain or taking it to the landfill and just dumping it in the landfill. Very similar in that they're transferring the oil from the beach.
Yeah, it expands your challenge. Instead of being able to identify the sort of the natural boundaries of this disaster, it's now spreading out into a larger realm.
Exactly. And I don't think people recognize that that's what they were doing, or certainly they wouldn't have done that. And then the other thing is we have to be environmentally sensitive. So each one of these beaches has its own environmentally sensitive characteristics. For instance, there's plovers on the beach, which when you're looking at that species, you know, you want to make sure that your cleanup efforts are not impacting their nesting areas. There are little lichens and critters that, you know, are identified with riprap areas, and you want to make sure in your cleaning strategies that you're not damaging them more in the cleaning process than perhaps Mother Nature and herself cleaning would do. So we take each one of these beaches and each one of these locations, and we look at them from an environmentally sensitive perspective. So we develop cleanup strategies, and we use different cleanup products and different types of techniques in order to reduce our effect on the environment in our cleanup. So, yes, there's oil on the beach, but we know we need to clean this up, but we don't want to further harm the environment with our cleanup. So we work very closely with scientists and environmentalists to make sure that our cleanup strategies are the best for that particular location. I know that there's been some bad press in relationship to this particular incident, but from an on-the-ground and response effort, this has been an incredibly coordinated response. And the agencies and the partners and the contractors in a unified command system really came together to respond to this particular event. And the way that the response was activated and the amount of equipment and personnel and supplies that were cascaded in, it really was an effective response. I've been on numerous ones. This one was a well-coordinated effort to mitigate the environmental damage that was associated with this particular disaster.
I recall when I first looked at the breaking story, I did notice that there were numbers to call. The O'Brien's Group also works with specific groups who have expertise, particularly in wildlife recovery in these situations. Talk about how they work with them, and then probably the best way for citizens who have an interest in helping, the best way for them to work with these groups.
Just as when the initial call comes in, the O'Brien's Group calls their contractors, the response contractors who take the vessels out there, also underneath the cascade of umbrella of network folks that are in the O'Brien's pocket is the Wildlife Care Network. And the Wildlife Care Network is an organization that responds to incidents to recover boiled birds and mammals. And so the Wildlife Care Network was activated immediately. And in that response, they did provide a number for people who wanted to volunteer in the efforts to be trained in recovering wildlife and then also trained in the cleaning and the rehabilitation and then the release of these particular birds in this case into the environment. So that number was actually posted relatively quickly on how people could volunteer to help in the wildlife recovery.
They get some very hands-on, quick training so that they can be effective volunteers.
Well, you got to remember that you're dealing with wildlife, and so just as we don't want to harm the environment in our cleanup efforts, you certainly don't want to stress or harm the birds in your capturing efforts. So each volunteer has to have a certain amount of training. And so when they're going to capture these boiled wildlife, that they're not actually doing more harm than good.
I can really relate to the concept of trying to do the right thing and ending up stressing a bird. I know a number of years ago I was working at a state park and there was a pelican stranded on the lake, and it was getting late and the pelican was supposed to be on its way and it wasn't. So another naturalist and I went out onto this little pond with our canoes, two canoes, and we thought we'd be able to catch this bird relatively easily. 2 hours later, we had been really making fools of ourselves out there chasing this poor pelican around, and we were stressing that bird out. We finally did catch the bird, but I was quite amazed at how, although I thought I knew what I was doing, I really didn't have a proper clue of how best to deal with this. And, of course, you're dealing with so many different animals, and one of the stories that I heard as well is that in the process of trying to catch some of the birds, they ended up running wild, heading actually back into the dangerous waters. So proper education and knowing what you're doing is really critical, and trying to really coordinate this, which is what you're working on. Really commend you for that.
Thank you. So this particular effort took place over a 24-hour operational period. They found that by using lighting at night, they were able to mesmerize the wildlife, actually, and it would cause less stress than the capture technique if they lit the birds at night and actually were able to capture them that way. So there was a lot of birds on the beaches. There was a lot of collected dead birds on the beaches. Some of the birds were oiled and some were not. So then once they capture this wildlife, they bring them back to the facility. The birds that were oiled are then subjected to an examination to check their overall health, how much they've actually been oiled, and after they undergo the examination, they then go through the cleaning process, which uses Dawn dishwashing detergent, and they use toothbrushes and very gentle cleaning techniques and multiple cleanings of each individual bird, and they take these individual birds once they've been through the cleaning process, and they put them through the drying and fluffing process, and then put them in a holding kind of little, like, wet area. You know, they've got water associated with it where they hold the birds until they're properly rehabilitated and then released. Now, this particular incident has been a real success story in the fact that we've already had a release of birds back into the environment down in Half Moon Bay. So birds were picked up, they were cleaned, they were rehabilitated, and then released. That's a success story.
Let's talk about where you are in this process and where do you go from here?
Currently, this particular incident, there is no more recoverable product on the water, and the operations staff are focusing now on shoreline. And when I say shoreline, I'm talking about different types of shoreline. We have our beaches, we have riprap, we have the marshes and marinas and piers and docks. So the shoreline encompasses multiple different types. And so with each of these different types of shoreline, there's different techniques for cleanup. And as with when we were talking about cleaning up the shoreline, as with marinas and piers and riprap and you know, historical rock walls and that sort of thing, each technique requires a different process. So we work hand-in-hand with scientists to develop the cleaning strategy that can best effectively pick up the product. Now, oil is dynamic. So you may clean a beach one day, and then due to tides and currents and different flow of the ocean, the next thing you may come back and find additional tar balls. So this particular incident has now evolved into what we call project management phase, where we have a team of many teams out there that monitor each beach every single day. And when they find products, they clean it up. And we're doing different techniques for cleaning riprap, different techniques for cleaning historical walls, different techniques for marinas and piers. And so just identifying each particular area that needs to be cleaned and the best solution for cleaning and then implementing. And then along with that, there was a lot of vessels moored and anchored in the bay, and each one of those vessels may or may not have been impacted by the event. So in addition to that, we've set up a non-response vessel cleaning program. So even though the vessels weren't involved in the response, they may have been impacted. Pleasure boats, historical boats, ferries, anything that, you know, utilizes the bay could have been impacted by this particular event. So in response to that, the O'Brien's group and the planning and operations section have set up a non-response vessel cleaning protocol standard. And with that, they'll set up different cleaning stations, different techniques for cleaning different vessels, and people will be able to either file a claim for damages to their vessel, or they can also respond and have utilizing our cleaning strategies and have their vessel cleaned. As we're looking at this project management phase, I mean, that becomes part of that whole picture.
And how long do you project out that you'll be involved in this cleanup?
We'll be there as long as the state determines is necessary. So, you know, the environmental compliance folks and the state regulators will determine when clean is clean. So as the contractor and the Burns Group, they will stay until it's determined clean is clean.
Mm-hmm.
And now that determination does not come from the responsible party. That determination comes from the state.
Thank you so much. That gives people a good overview of what's involved. And it's very complex. I mean, there are just so many aspects to this. And just in terms of trying to determine the proper cleaning agents for these various elements also involves, you know, tons of regulation. And then you have to dispose of that as well. So,
and huge support. I mean, each one of those cleaning sites is supported by, you know, PPE, you know, personal protective equipment, Tyvek suits, you know, that porta potties, you know, waste bins for disposing of the hazardous materials, you know, transportation issues, you know, hotel requirements, feeding, you know, just logistically, you know, staging areas, decontamination facilities, supply stations, you know, a whole host of things logistically go into support this. So even, you know, for each particular beach segment, there is a logistical support associated with each one of those beach segments.
Fascinating. Unfortunately, these accidents do happen, and
they're
certainly going to happen in the future again. I'm just curious, as you, with the O'Brien's group, as you look at emerging potential challenges as our Earth is changing here, are there any new types of challenges that you're trying to imagine you may have to deal with?
And with any kind of response, I know Katrina had oil issues associated with the situation that happened with the hurricane. And so as the climate changes and as, you know, you get more flooding or hurricanes, I know the O'Brien's group is still working in a place called Coffeyville, which is located in the Midwest, associated with a flood event. Now, a significant flood and oil on water and, you know, the response to that. So as the climate changes and you see hurricanes or floods or earthquakes or anything associated with that, there will be other responses associated with that particular natural disaster. We train, put on drills and exercises, we hire subcontractors, we train with those people. So if that situation occurs, we know, I call it likened to being an orchestra director, where you ting the bell and, you know, you point and people respond. And in this response, the music was on key. The response to this incident was exactly as it was intended to be as far as the rules and regulations go. The calls were made, the responsible people responded immediately per the protocols that were in place. And, you know, you have to look at it from a safety standpoint. You know, safety is always the number one concern. So where somebody from the public is not going to run into a burning structure without thinking about their safety, you know, we also do that same thing. So working in a hazardous environment, you know, we respond to the event and we keep responding to the event until we're told that it's clean and it's done, and then we go home.
We've been talking with Cheryl Surface, who is working with the O'Brien's Group, which is focused directly on the oil spill happening in San Francisco. Cheryl, if people want to find out about the O'Brien's Group, how can they do so?
We actually have a website, theobriensgroup.com, and they're welcome to go there.
Well, good luck in the future here. You got your hands full, and great talking to you, Cheryl.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. As we gather to celebrate Thanksgiving this year, take just a moment to reflect on what a different world we've become since those pilgrims spent their first Thanksgiving with the Native Americans who shared their bounty with the New Worldians who were trying to learn to survive off the earth. As we look to our future, those original sustainable communities deserve a little attention. For they had survived off the land for thousands of years and developed some of the most monumental cultures on earth. Happy Thanksgiving.
'Tis the gift to be simple, 'tis the gift to be free, 'tis the gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we are in the place just right, we'll be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend we will not be ashamed. To turn, 'twill be our delight, till by turning, turning we come round, round.
This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Tuesday or anytime on the archives when your voice of the earth rings out around the world here on the Wild Side News.